Hello and welcome to Leave Your Mark. I'm your host, Scott Livingston, and this is where I explore the influences that have shaped the lives of our incredible guests. These are the stories of lives worth talking about. Follow me on Twitter at Built by Scott and Instagram at King O'Payne, or link up with me on my Facebook fan page, Scott G. Livingston. My goal is to empower and inspire a community of people who take every opportunity to live a high-performing life. Before I get started on today's podcast, I want to take a moment to connect you with my sponsor, ReconditioningHQ.com. Reconditioning is a method and language of integrated practice. It brings the worlds of therapy and conditioning together and helps them become more powerful and more practical. If you live in one or both of these worlds, or you use the services of a therapist or conditioning coach, you know that sometimes they don't see eye to eye. They aren't on the same page. Reconditioning provides a time-tested process for aligning these two worlds and creating impactful solutions to performance problems. And now the entire approach is available for you to digest online from the comfort of your own home. Follow them at Reconditioning HQ on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook, or become a member of their Facebook Reconditioning HQ Revolution community and join the Reconditioning Revolution. Team up with Matrix. If you're striving for that competitive edge, make sure Matrix is on your team so you have everything you need to build a winner from start to finish. With over 500 products, exclusive training tools, and years of experience, we can help you create a facility that maximizes athletic potential in new ways. We can deliver a wide range of complete programming solutions to build strength, explosiveness, speed, and agility in athletes of all kinds. Our partnerships with coaching professionals make it easy to access expert insight that enhances the way your team trains. And of course, everything Matrix is engineered and tested to meet the most stringent international standards for safety and quality. So we'll be with you season after season for years. For more information, go to Matrix Canadian team site, teamupwithmatrix.com/CA. How would you like to increase your athletic performance and reduce your risk of injury? If this sounds good to you, please allow me to introduce you to the all-new ISOFIT MSK. The multi-patented ISOFIT MSK is the world's first full-body, portable, isometric strength training device. Since launching in November 2020, the ISOFIT MSK is now helping thousands of people across 18 countries live pain-free, high-performing lifestyles. Whether your goal is to enhance muscle strength and endurance, improve neuromuscular potentiation, strengthen tendons and bones, or enhance cardiovascular performance, the ISOFIT MSK does it all. To learn more about the ISOFIT MSK, please visit www.isofitmsk.ca. That's ISOFIT with a P-H-I-T, MSK.ca. Remember to use the discount code IHPS at checkout to save yourself $250 per unit. The ISOFIT MSK is proudly made in Canada. We are here with Leave Your Mark's performance conversations between myself and the grand Dominic Gauthier, who is in Vancouver, and I am in the east of Canada. And we have a beautiful and amazing guest today, Allison Forsyth, former alpine skier with Team Canada. And we are honored to have her come and talk to us today. We're going to get into the topic of safe sport and really why that is a mission of hers. But first, welcome, Allison. Thanks for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me. It's great to be here, and I'm always happy to talk and do anything I can to make the world and the sport world more aware of safe sport. So thank you for having me.
Thank you. For the listener, you know, maybe you can sort of outline why this mission is of importance to you. What has happened in your career that you at this stage are making it a mission to change sport from a safety perspective?
Yes,
what
of
that,
course.
What that means in essence too.
Yeah, sure. So, you know, safe sport, I often say is can be a challenging topic for some people to speak about. And so my number one mandate is I talk about it all the time to anyone that wants to listen. And I'm very open and honest about sharing my personal story, because I also believe that nothing has as much power as hearing firsthand from someone who's had a safe sport negative experience. So in a Cole's Notes version, obviously, and if you Google my name, and not to say to Google me, but you'll see more information, of course. But in the Cole's Notes version of the story, I was a victim of sexual abuse in the late 90s as a member of the Canadian Junior National Ski Team. In that situation, I mean, I'm happy as we go along here to talk in depth about, you know, what actually occurred in a professional way. But the really big thing for me was there was multiple girls that were being sexually abused by one predator on the ski team at that time. And, you know, it happened and we had a very horrific and traumatizing experience for a few different reasons, but mainly I would say a very strong gap in the system around sport at that time, including a complete absence of training and education, not putting in, having the proper safeguards in place to prevent issues from happening, you know, mediocre policies at best, and cultural norms that sort of were conducive to, you know, predators being a part of our sport anyway. And I think most sports at that time, nothing happened. So we were sexually abused and for, you know, to be quite honest, for 17 years, it was covered up and very clearly. And, you know, I had a very firsthand experience with that level of a cover up. It was swept under the rug. And of course, you know, back then culturally, there is, you know, there's always gossip about, oh, so-and-so is having an intimate relationship with their coach. And there was a lack of knowledge on the difference between, you know, being in a relationship with a coach and of course being a minor, that is impossible. But even just being in a personal friendship relationship with a coach, there was just a lack of knowledge around, you know, what does that actually mean? And what is taking that relationship too far? Something that became very clear to me subsequently was I was a victim of grooming. And that's one of the things that I'm most passionate sharing with people, because it's actually, unfortunately, not known. And we can get into that, of course, you know, how the grooming process works when it comes to these extreme cases of abuse and assault with athletes. And also it was just never trained or educated on for us. So, you know, flash forward to 2015, and I'll just be quick. An incredible, amazing woman named Geneviève Simard actually saw our abuser back coaching again. And so what he had done is he had that feeling, like my impression of it anyway, was that, oh, I got busted. People know that I do this, but oh, look, no one's doing anything about it. So I'm just going to go and sort of lay low for a while. And if you were to ask me, I think that his abusive tendencies and his nature did not stop for those 17 years. I don't believe that's possible. But on record, I would be deemed the last victim of his in 1998. Just to back up 1 second, I mean, we went through a very long, arduous criminal trial. And what he had done, and because he's a very sick individual, is he had actually kept a shoebox of physical evidence in his closet in his bedroom. And what was in that shoebox was letters. I'm gonna take us all back to the world before social media here, and very minimal text messaging as well. And he'd actually kept proof that he had done this to multiple girls, underage girls. And so because of that, when Geneviève Simard, she saw him coaching again and she was like, no, and she spent 24 hours. It took her 24 hours of talking to every single powerful person she knew before she finally ended up at the police station in Mont-Tremblant, Quebec. She told the police, and within 12 hours, sirens, arrests, everything took place. So we went through a criminal trial. He was accused of 58 charges of sexual abuse, assault, misconduct. He was convicted of 38 of those charges. The trial took over 2.5 years because he continually tried to fire his lawyers and get new representation, et cetera. He, to this day, shows no remorse, and to this day still thinks that he was not guilty. And 38 of those charges stuck. And I'm very proud to have been one of the witnesses to the crown. It was challenging for me. I had to testify at his trial a day after my baby was born. So any new mothers out there can attest to the hormonal and emotional implications of having a baby. And so one of my sad moments, and I'll never regret being a part of that trial and doing what I had to do to see him go to prison. But I didn't get to enjoy the first, honestly, like the month before I had the baby and probably the month after because of this. I never knew when that call was going to come to testify. So I stood strong with, you know, 11 other victims at that time. The reason why he was not convicted of more charges, and mine would also fall into this bucket, is because the charges that were laid against him that were concerning me, again, with a criminal trial, you have to have an extreme level of physical evidence and an extremely high standard of proof. And so where I had that standard of proof, those charges were happening outside of Canada. So I think something else that's very broken in our criminal justice system is right now, athletes that are traveling overseas representing our country are not covered under these circumstances. So unfortunately, those charges were dismissed. The judge actually went on record and was almost tearful, saying he it was outside of his jurisdiction to charge him with these charges. And it was a very traumatizing experience in our lives, both while the abuse was happening, obviously, and then after, because of the way that it was covered up. And I started to feel, as you would hear from most victims of sexual abuse, whether it's our case, a coercive, manipulative, and physical situation, or if you're sexually abused or assaulted by a stranger, is you get a feeling of, well, what did I do wrong? Why, you know, this must have been my fault. I wore the wrong thing. In sport, it's the, I want the attention of the coach. He has the power over me. He has the future that he's saying he's going to take me to the top of my sport. So the complicity in it and that sense of responsibility was incredibly traumatizing for me, especially because I felt nobody was supporting me. And quite literally at that time, nobody was. So that's the Coles Notes version. And now I'm a very strong and open and, you know, passionate sport advocate around safe sport. I can go into what I've done, but maybe we can talk about that in a little bit. But that's sort of the basis of why I got into safe sport to begin with, was my own personal experience.
And well, it's after that, very well spoken. And I think words matter so much in all of this, like hearing you the last 5-6 minutes, like every words that you're using, you know, and calling him a predator, not a coach. It resonates a lot with me because it's not a coach, it's a predator. And then, you know, maltreatment, all of these words, and I've been in the file myself quite a bit, involved in some ways, and it's quite complex, right? Like how we label things and how we label them matters a lot as to what the outcomes will be. And I know this is what you're working in. So, I just wanted to reinforce that this is a big part of the battle, but you're definitely, one of those that is leading the way there. And we got to push this further. And I find myself that it's been a bit slow. Is that what you felt? I mean, obviously we would like all of this to be happening right now. We understand that things take time. There's legal implication in all of this, but you've been like both feet in it. Like, is that some frustrations that you've had seeing that things are just like so slow to process? And even things that for us are evidence. It's like, yeah, this should be done right away, but for some reason, politics, bureaucracy, it's not. Like,
yes,
the frustrations that you've faced.
Yeah, there's two major frustrations that I'm happy to share, and I'll just tell a quick story around them. So what actually happened in our case was after the criminal trial, I will not take credit for this. Dom, you know a bit about this, but four of the victims from Quebec actually contacted me because they were in consideration of having what's called the publicity ban lifted. What that means is in a criminal trial of sexual nature, you know, the witnesses to the Crown are given pseudonyms. Your name is not used to protect, you know, victims. And that's great. After the fact, however, what they were recognizing, and then when I got on board, what we all were recognizing was, you know, why is it okay that we just lock this guy up, but the sports system doesn't seem to think they need to make any changes? Like, to put it in layman's terms, that's exactly what we realized was happening. We had our publicity ban lifted. The athletes, along with myself, did a lot of media, and we really lobbied the federal government right to that level of Trudeau's sport minister, Kirsty Duncan, at the time, to put in place important changes to the Canadian sports system. So here's where the frustration comes in. One is the government of Canada in a federal nature, and I totally appreciate a lot of the whys behind it. My feeling is it's very slow moving. In a situation like this, I don't understand why. I appreciate the processes that are put in place for the reasons they are, but this is a serious situation in our country, and it's not going away. So I would ask, why did it take over 3 years to even get to where we are? And then the second thing is jurisdiction. So what occurred, which was very positive, is through the Red Deer Declaration that Minister Duncan put in place, national sporting organizations, and just for people that don't know what that means, those are the national governing bodies of each sport in Canada, which would be your Soccer Canada, your Alpine Canada, your Hockey Canada. That's called the NSO level of sport. And those levels of sport are federally funded by Sport Canada. So the changes that were put in place for those sports, mandatory training and education, third-party safety officer, reporting of any maltreatment cases, and abiding by a universal code of conduct, they only go to that NSO level. They only affect change for national teams. Let's be honest, most national teams are full of a lot of adults and not a lot of youth. Mm-hmm. So provincial organizational levels and club levels within Canada are not currently supported or funded under this new national mandate. So those are my two frustrations, as I feel, as part of why I'm doing now for my consulting business around safe sport, is I feel we are neglecting where it really should start, which is with children at the clubs. And that they are trained and they are educated, and these, you know, predators or even, you know, abusive coaches, because maltreatment is a very vast situation, not mm-hmm. just sexual issues. That's not happening at the club level. Why is it that we think that we can do something at the national team and it will, you know, organically trickle down? I don't believe mm-hmm. in that at all. So those are my two major frustrations, is the time it's taken, as well as what are we as, you know, Canadian citizens and the government of Canada doing to support the grassroots level of sport around maltreatment?
First of all, I want to compliment you for coming on, talking about this and being vulnerable about it, because it's only through that vulnerability and that expression that people can actually understand it and maybe do something about it. You know, obviously the legislative part of it is a big part of it, and the actual implementation of whatever is legislated is a big part of it. But I think also awareness is the limiting factor. And I think a lot of parents and people in sport who, you know, I think of this now as a father of a 12 going on 13 year old, you know, one side of you wants to be, you know, non-judgmental of the coaching group and give your child to the coaching group so they can, you know, do whatever it is that they need to do to get them, you know, to wherever it is that they're going to go with whatever sport that your child is excited about. But you're not also given the tools of, and I'm somebody, as you know, and Dom is somebody who obviously lives in sport and has lived in sport. And I don't really know what the red flags are or the signs I should mm-hmm. recognize, other than something that's Captain Obvious. So I really would like to go back first to unpack this a little bit and understand mm-hmm. these, you know, you mentioned grooming, and what is the insidious nature of how this occurs, so parents can start to recognize and kids can maybe start to recognize and people who are in the sport can recognize when it's going on and can intervene or change or do something about it. But first and foremost, we have to have some level of awareness. So what are those signs? What are the things that start to happen to create this situation in the first place? ReconditioningHQ.com is announcing the creation of the R Pro series. There are now 4 steps to becoming a reconditioning professional. It all starts with our signature course, R1 Foundations, that sets you up with this unique, holistic approach to integrating the power of therapeutic practice and performance practice. This course, as well as the second course in our series, R2 Designs, is completely online. You can register and digest all the content from the comfort of your own home. Each course comes with a Zoom lab experience, where we take all the information and work with you to ensure you completely understand how to align it with your own practice. The third step, the R3 experience. This is a complete 8-week mentorship online where we go deep on the entire process and make certain you are prepared to succeed. Finally, we'll be releasing our first R4 collab sometime near the end of 2021. This will be an incredible live event where we use collaborative teaching design to manipulate the process with you and everyone in attendance so that everyone learns the nuances of the reconditioning process and leave being prepared to call yourself a reconditioning professional. For more information on all our courses, including our landmark personal development program, Empower You, please check out reconditioninghq.com today and use the coupon code LYM50 for $50 off any one of our course offering. You want data? We've got data. You can now add real-time biometric testing and data monitoring to your ISOFIT MSK. Thanks to our partnership with Kinvent, you can easily transform your ISOFIT MSK into a state-of-the-art testing and training platform. Monitoring your athlete's progress has never been easier. With the K-Force ISOFIT Pack, you can easily send real-time acoustic and optic biofeedback to your smartphone or tablet. To learn more about the ISOFIT MSK and K-Force ISOFIT Pack, visit www.isofitphitmsk.ca today. Matrix Fitness Canada partners with Coach Mark Fitzgerald to oversee its athletic performance program across the country. Mark is based in Kelowna, BC, with operations in multiple provinces serving athletes and families of various age groups. Most recently, the strength and conditioning coach for the Anaheim Ducks, Mark is also the head of performance and owns Elite Training Systems, a high-performance training center that caters to athletes across multiple sports. Matrix Fitness views all of us as athletes, and it is our goal to make better movement and fitness accessible to all. The Matrix Fitness Canada Performance Team will assist with program development, space and facility consults, and developing outreach programs for organizations who train competitive athletes and athletes at heart. Matrix Fitness has a full portfolio of fitness, performance, and medical equipment and programs designed to serve various populations. For more information on how Matrix can help with your objectives, go to teamupwithmatrix.com/CA today.
Yeah. And I almost get like goosebumps whenever anyone asks me this, because this is like my purpose in life. So it's a big deal for me. So thank you for asking. Here's what I want to say. Just first of all, there's many different forms of maltreatment, from physical abuse, psychological abuse, neglect, harassment. We're going to focus today on sexual harassment and sexual abuse. It's inarguably one of the most terrible ones. I just want to also highlight that there's a lot of other things that we should be watching out for. Mm-hmm. The first thing, first and foremost, is that you're not going to train and educate a predator or a pedophile out of being who that person is. So our job in sport is to keep the door closed and send them elsewhere. And that's what churches have done. That's what schools have done. So it begs the question as to why is the door still open in sport for these horrible people to come in? I will recommend right off the bat to educate, you know, parents, coaches, anyone should be educating themselves through what's out there right now. Two very great ways to educate yourself and to hear firsthand. And I would say, you know, like, just really ingrain yourself in what this is the podcast Believed, which is about the Nasser case, Larry Nasser case out of the US with gymnastics, and also Athlete A on Netflix, which is also an account of that case. It was obviously one of the worst cases the US had ever seen. But at the end of the day, it's great to educate yourself through materials and cases to understand. So back to your question about grooming. So it's so simple that it's people don't even think about it. So there's four specific stages. They go favoritism, then it goes into personal relationship, then it goes into isolation, and then it goes into complicity. So starting with favoritism, what you want to look for is when, first of all, your gut tells you, your brain will convince you otherwise. Because what I want under two things I want people to know before I say this, actually, sorry, I'm jumping around, is one is I call pedophiles of this nature the Ted Bundy effect. So they're going to be the last person that you think. They're going to be the most charismatic, likely the best coach based on their charisma, their enrolling, and also their style of coaching, whatever that may be. They're going to be, you know, like Ted Bundy was. Nobody thought that he could be a serial killer because he was, you know, a white Anglo-Saxon male in the 70s who was a lawyer. How could he murder women, right? So there's a cultural misunderstanding about who these people are. They expect them to look and dress a certain way. So it is actually the person in your child's organization or your organization that you least expect. That's number one. Number two, they groom the gatekeepers. So in my case, what I'm very clear on is there is a lot of people that knew this had happened. There is a lot of people that defended him. There's a lot of people who were directly involved in trying to cover this up so he never got in trouble and we, quote unquote, wouldn't lose sponsorships. Out of respect for them, and some of them I do have a lot of respect for because I feel like they were also victims of his. So grooming the gatekeeper is a very real thing. It's backed up by years of research. But what it looks like is that person manipulating the staff. Usually starts with who hired them. They have a way to manipulate their way through the system. They start to then groom the parent. So this is key. It's going to be the coach that comes to you. Not okay. I'm obviously generalizing here, so you know, don't take my word for all of this. But the way I feel and what I believe is, it's the coach that will come to you and say, your child, if they just stick with me, I've got them. And they almost become, because 95% of children that are abused know their abuser. They become, in some cases, and this happened in the Nassar case, they become almost like a part of your family. And that's what makes it more devastating. In my case, he had victims of his living with him and his parents. So just know that, like, there's people around that they will get and enroll and manipulate. Then when it comes to what they do with the athletes is they usually try to look for the most vulnerable. So the favoritism doesn't really make sense. The favoritism is not necessarily the best athlete on the team. The favoritism is what this predator thinks to be the most vulnerable target for him at that particular time. And he or she starts to just, you know, what favoritism is, spending more time with them, you know, whispering in their ear, you're going to be the best, I've got you, like all of these levels of coercive manipulation. And I mean, layman's terms, we were completely brainwashed. I would go on the record and say most of the victims of his would say to you, we were completely brainwashed by this man to believe whatever he said. So the favoritism then leads to inappropriate personal conduct. Whether that's physical, you know, you can start with the rubbing of the legs or the touching of the body parts. But more often it's, you know, what's going on in your life? Have you ever had sex? You know, who's your boyfriend? I don't think he's the right guy for mm-hmm. you. So that level of personal conduct, then there comes isolation. And that's when the abuse usually starts. What that looks like is, just so people are aware of what they may see is, you know, why is that coach or that person of authority or person in power driving that athlete to track practice every day? Why is, you know, why did my teammate, because there's so much power in witnesses and bystanders, which I can talk about in a bit because they see it clearly. Why is my teammate texting the coach and I'm not texting him? So he or she starts, and I'm using coaches as an example. It obviously can be anyone in personal power over this athlete, but mm-hmm. this coach finds a way to keep them away from everyone else physically or mentally. In our case, there was three of us on a young woman's team of 10 that were being sexually abused by the same man. And none of us knew. That's how good he was at isolating us against each other. How he did it was mental manipulation, isolation. So what that looks like, and if you can't tell, I've done lots of therapy, but I've learned this, guys. It's taken me 17 years, 18 now, but 20 now, actually. But is he would specifically say horrible things about one of the other victims so that I would never catch on or think that he could possibly be doing something with her as well. So he had a way of manipulating us against each other. And sort of, it's very common in an athlete world, as you both know, for them to jockey for attention and mm-hmm. and find, you know, where is that edge and why is that coach? Anyway, so that's isolation. And then comes the one that, you know, I've finally worked through, but it's the hardest for me and for most victims to overcome. It's what I mentioned at the top of the show is complicity. So they find a way to make you feel responsible. The most common way that this happens in sport, and I can only speak for sport, obviously, because this is the research that we've done around it, is they buy underage athletes alcohol or drugs. Usually it's alcohol. And in that case, then, as you can imagine, what ensues if it's an acute experience, it happens only once as an example, is that athlete feels, well, you know, he got me alcohol. That was my fault. I'm going to get in trouble. I chose to drink alcohol. I got quote unquote drunk. So they don't want to say anything because of that. In our case, it was a little bit more complicated. He was very mastermind of the mind, but they find a way to make you feel like you caused it or were contributing to it happening, which then leads to you feeling like you need to be silenced and not stand up and say anything about it. So those are it. Favoritism, over-personal connection, isolation, and complicity.
And what happens when you maybe you start to contemplate that you know, this is wrong or it's not something that should be happening. But what is the but statement that goes through your mind or the fear statement that goes through your mind as the athlete that if I say something, I'm going to lose my position on the team. I'm going to be kicked out. I'm going to lose his favoritism, all these different things that mm-hmm. are weighing on your mind. Even if at some point you have this recognition that what's going on isn't probably kosher, so to speak.
Yeah, exactly. Great. So I'll speak obviously from my direct experience. And I've said this, you know, I've talked about this before and another victim and I also spoke of this is you in my circumstance, I got to a place where it sounds, you know, everyone just needs to know that, you know, I'm a whole person, but I have my vulnerabilities. But it was easier to stay with him in that situation than get away. He had a way of you know, brainwashing me and manipulating me into thinking not only was he going to, you know, be my coach for the rest of my life, but, you know, he wanted to have my babies and this and that. And then every time I would try to get away from him or end it, or, you know, remember we were very isolated as a team traveling around together in a small group. So just physical vicinity was obviously a challenge to get away. One of the victims went on the record and said she used to sleep outside in the snow. And so he had a masterful way of coercing me into doing it. The extreme example would be he wouldn't enter me into races. You know, after he physically assaulted me the first time, he basically just said, well, we're in it now. And I'll speak directly to my case is I had nowhere to go. This is why I'm trying to change the system. I had no idea who I could report to, who I could tell, where I was going to be safe, who would believe me. None of that existed back there. Back then, there was no independent place for me to report. And then athletes fear this, and I experienced it. Fear of retribution, it being covered up, which is exactly what happened. Ostracization from fellow teammates, and that happened to me extreme in my case because I was the whistleblower, and I basically took away the best coach. So it is not an easy thing to do, to stand up and do what is necessary. But I think that's critical to know. And what we're trying to do right now is have people understand that you won't be able to live with yourself if you don't do something, whether you're a victim or you saw this happening. And just to speak to witnesses for a second, especially in sexual abuse or sexual cases, obviously I can speak honestly and authentically about this. I didn't see it once I was in it. You see it, you know it, but you're just in it and you start to lose weight. And I started to, like, my eating disorder kicked in and I was just extremely unhealthy. And there's no way other people didn't see that. And so other people saw the way that he was behaving and didn't say anything. And so the power of the bystander and the power of the witness is essential because they see it clearly. Mm-hmm. And when you're trapped in a, you know, malicious, coercive, abusive situation, you don't. And the thing that I would say to the listeners to compare that against is domestic abuse. So a lot of people that have never been in a, you know, a marital domestic abuse situation would maybe think, well, why didn't he or she just leave? Why didn't they just pack up the kids and go? Mm-hmm. But I can tell you, I know firsthand to, like, the core of who I am, why that is so challenging. So I would just ask people to put on their, there's something more to this than just walking out the door and it not happening again hats, and respect that it's a very complicated, complex mental game that is being played on you.
Well, I love what you, the messages you gave to the parents, you know, mm-hmm. all of us being parents now, I think that's key. And one thing you mentioned that, man, I could not, well, I don't know if you guys agree, but for me, it's something I strongly believe in. Like, those coaches that tell your kids, or you, if you're an athlete listening, that they will make you, that they will bring you to the top. Okay. I've been a coach myself. It's all bullshit. Mm-hmm. There's not one coach good enough on this planet that can create somebody. They can break somebody. They cannot make somebody. I've coached Olympic athletes, Olympic champions. But, you know, like Alex Bilodeau and Jennifer Heil, if they didn't have what they already had, like, it doesn't matter how good I was. I mean, I helped them. I think I had a big impact, but I think other coaches could have done it too, which actually they did. Like Michel Amelin coached Alex Bilodeau in Sochi. And it was a very, very difficult 4 years for Alex with the rivalry with Michael Kingsbury. And there was a lot of tension and all this. Well, Michel did it. Like, it's mm-hmm. other people, if you have that talent, if you're that good at something at age of 12, 13, 14, don't think there's one person that can make you. And if they say so, I think that's one sign, Scotty, just run the other way. Like, this yeah. is already, I mean, if I would hear that, I would just pull my kid out of there. There's no way this coach, I mean, and then
all that's the actually a great warning sign. It's a great point, Dom. And something I'll say to that is, I have heard firsthand, and I won't say that it was sexual abuse or assault, but I have heard firsthand, terrifyingly, from parents who almost disregard maltreatment of their child because they're so convinced that that coach yeah. is so needed. And that's why I've done a video where I literally said, like, kids do not want to win that bad to have this happen to them. And parents need to respect that and that we would I would give every medal back I had ever won.
Totally.
And most of my medals were earned in a place of mental grievance and anger and fear and frustration. I spent my entire skiing career trying to prove him wrong because he had me so convinced that if I wasn't under his spell and he wasn't coaching me, I'd never make it. And that's what fueled me. And sure, I've also had people in a very strong, powerful positions within organizations use the excuse of, well, Allison was successful.
Wow,
does that drive me freaking nuts?
Yeah.
I was like, you are defining success in a very bad way. Because do you think a mentally unstable, angry woman who then uses that anger to prove an abuser wrong, and yes, okay, she makes the Olympics and she's top of the world for 10 years, you think that's successful? So we also have to mind flip in sport what we think success actually is. Because A, like you said, it's not the coach. And B, it's success is not worth it when it comes to a maltreatment.
And you guys, I mean, I was at the end of my career during those years, right? So I would run into you guys around the glaciers, around the world. And the talent group that you guys were, like, we've never had that in this sport ever, in alpine skiing. A group of women like that, you were probably like 6, 7, or 8, I couldn't name right away, that could be in the top 5 in the world, at one point in their career, right? So he just happened to be there. He didn't create you, to my point again, right? Like another coach could have taken that group and who knows, maybe make it better. Would have certainly been a better experience, longer career. So I'm convinced more results at the end of the day. So he was not the creator of that success. Like, far from it.
Yeah. I think too, it's this power thing that I think most people don't totally recognize, but I remember working for the New York Rangers when Theo Fleury came to the Rangers, and Theo was near the end of his career and really struggling with a lot of alcohol and drug abuse based on the fact that he had been abused by his coach. And he was part of that group with Sheldon Kennedy, who had the coach that had
Graham done James.
Terrible things. Yeah. Graham James, who had done terrible things to these young men. And, you know, everybody sort of said, well, why don't you, like you said, why don't you just exit stage left? But the key is too, that your perception is that the only way you can have success, this person has convinced you that they are your ticket to for these boys was their ticket to the NHL. And so if they turned wrong or turned left on him, their chance to have that dream was going to be gone. And, you know, it's the same thing that, you know, I'm sure that was going on in your guys' world as well. And
The problem, just to close on that, Scotty, because you talk about team sports, and I think that's also a big problem on team sports or judge sports, is it's that team selection thing, and that's where they have the power and the control, and that's the threat on the athletes. You're going to make the team, and you're not. You know, that's another level of abuse in a sport where it's the clock, it's time. At one point, the coach can't decide everything, but in cases of, well, even in skiing, right? They still select the national team, right? Like, so there's still some subjectivity involved, not as much, but some. But when it's making the team or not, we see it with the artistic swimming situation. That's completely what's happening. This abuse that's been on for decades now that we've tried again to break because women dared to speak up, and still they haven't been really heard to the point where that culture is changing. And the roots of it, well, as many roots probably, but one of them is that they're all threatened by the coach, who is ultimately the single person deciding who's on the 8 that's going to be in the pool at the Olympics. Well, I've been an athlete myself, like Ali, and we're so obsessed in winning the Olympics, we're willing to do anything to get there at that point in our career, right? So imagine the power, imagine the influence they can have. So we got to remove that from coaches. One person or two should not be the ones deciding who makes it and who doesn't, because that's very putting the athletes in a vulnerable place.
Yeah, and that's why I say, you know, sport is a breeding ground for this. It's not just that we don't have the proper safeguards in place. It's because the environment, cultural norms within a sport, and I'm speaking to all forms of maltreatment. You saw what happened with NHL hockey, and suddenly every last year or 2 years ago, suddenly everyone went, oh, it's not normal that my coach, you know, there's these norms in sport. And the mindset of an athlete, like the goals, the dreams, the, you know, it's just a breeding ground for maltreatment. And, you know, there was a case just settled last week with Water Polo USA for $14 million, where a coach was, you know, again, like Larry Nassar in the US was using medical masking, medical treat abuse as medical treatment. And so it's, you know, it's something that I think we have to be so aware of. And then my main point, though, which is why I don't actually like the Athlete A Netflix show, because right after that aired, I got a call from my great friends at Gymnastics Canada, and they were devastated because it painted gymnastics in such a bad light that what is the worst thing that could happen for me is people don't put their children in sport because of this. Sport is a beautiful place to raise your children, for them to get lifelong skills and like mindset, and just, I highly encourage sport. And if I ever speak about my circumstance, I'm always clear that it's about education and shifting the system to prevent, not just deal with once it happens. Oh, this happened. Now what do we do about it? We have to shift. We have to prevent it from happening. And being aware and self-educated on policies, travel policies, all of like, just be mindful and smart and educated before you put your child into something. But man, sport is still a wonderful place for children. I have all three of mine in competitive sport. So I just wouldn't want anyone to think not to put their child in sport because of this.
I don't know if you're comfortable with this part of the conversation, but I would really, as a father, I would love to know, like, when you first had to talk about this with your mom and dad about what happened, like, tell us about that if you're comfortable with it. Like, were they kind of like, oh, like completely shocked, or did they recognize things and all of a sudden you started putting pieces of the puzzle together, or how did that kind of come together?
Yeah. So a couple of things I'll mention here. One is, and Dom could speak articulately to this as well, but one of the things about skiing is that you're on the road for up to 300 days a year. Mm-hmm. So I would say in all accuracy for all of my teammates at the time, and probably even now, you have very little parental involvement in your life once you're shipped on the road with your teams. The second piece is, out of respect for sport, things have changed. So I grew up in sport in an era where it was normal for me as an 11-year-old to go on a bus and go to a ski race with a 19-year-old male coach. Like, these kind of things, I hope, don't happen. Like, these don't happen anymore in general. But to your point, Scott, it's my parents only found out after the fact when I told them. And I told them because he wasn't even fired. We found that out later. He resigned from the ski team. And I just went home and told them. No one else told them. The team never contacted them. So my dad, he may listen to this, but I think he's been struggling with it ever since. And he doesn't, to be honest, know how to really access that struggle. Because when I went through the trial was the first time that he sort of went, whoa, like, this was a big deal, right? Out of respect to him and the fact that I had a huge lack of support from the team, my teammates, everyone, once I blew the whistle, I probably, to him, out of respect for who he was, downplayed the situation a lot. And he didn't actually find the gravity of it till we went to trial. My mother, on the other hand, who unfortunately has passed away, I didn't know this, but her wife has since told me that she consistently and constantly was calling, you know, the offices of the administrators of Alpine Canada at that time. And they, according to her wife, said to her what was said to me, which is, you know, Marion, you need to make a choice here. You either fight this for your daughter or she has a career. So there was that ultimatum where I feel like my mom was also silenced. Mm-hmm. So I, you know, it's hard for me to speak about this. The one thing that would probably make me emotional, because I have three kids. Nah, we have kids, like, oh, like, if this happened to them, like, I didn't even, I'll be frank, I didn't know how much I was still dealing with this until once the trial happened, it unrolled everything for me. I have a lot of years of coping, and I have, I've been working through chronic PTSD, lots of therapy. I'm very open about my mental health challenges, my substance abuse challenges, my eating disorder. Like, I'm very open about all of that because I'm trying to destigmatize healing as well. But I dropped my son off for the first time at a gymnastics practice where I wasn't allowed in because the parents weren't, and I had a full blown hyperventilation panic attack. And I didn't even know at that point, he was probably 4 or 5. This was 7 years ago. I didn't even know where it was coming from. That's how much I buried this at that time. So I struggle a lot. I struggled a lot as a parent having trust. And then I had to educate myself, talk to people, get to know the policies, know what their safeguards were in place before I even could say, like, sure, take my son, stranger. you know, and I will say Hockey Canada, they've had their fair share of issues. We all know that. And God bless Sheldon Kennedy for what he did for that sport. And they still have issues, but hockey, I would say is, you know, all the parents have to participate in the respect in sport training. There's the rule there. It's the first place I ever heard about the rule of two was when I put my kids in minor hockey here in Oakville, Ontario. So there is efforts being made, but it is not enough across all the sports in Canada for sure. Mm.
Do you feel there's still people, because it's such a, how can you be against that, right? Like, but again, if it's slow, is it because some people are still having a hard time to not just put these things in place, but accept that we need to change that culture, and some very influential people, I guess, don't want some of their cultures to change that quickly. I mean, it's horrible to think that some people might be against that, but
yeah, I would say philosophically, I don't think anyone's against it, but what I've experienced is, both personally and with the work I do, you know, some intentions, around, and if an organization were to come to me in the consulting work I do and say, yes, you know, we do training and education with our athletes, I say, okay, great. So can I call up one of your athletes and ask if they did it? Did they listen? Did they, you know, and I say the same thing about policies. Like, to be honest, who gives about a policy when an athlete doesn't know how to read it, doesn't understand the legal language of it? Yeah. It's on page 995 of their athlete agreement. It's buried. You know, I've had circumstances with my own children where I've signed on to policies by enrolling them in a certain activity, and all the policies are on the first, second page. And then it literally has said, like, sexual harassment policy, come see us in our office or something. And I'm like, so people make it a dirty word. They don't want to talk about it. Organizations, if they're, you know, here's the thing. If you know you're a good person, your morality goes, oh, but I wouldn't do this as an administrator. I'm not this kind of coach. And I tell people, I'm like, what happens when you leave? You're going to retire in 4 years. You're not going to be a coach in 20 years. This isn't about you. It's about shifting the entire system of sport in Canada. Like, get on board. This is a big deal. But I think people personalize it. And then I hate to say it, I think budgets come into play. And I will go everywhere I go and speak. I say, you know, you should be paying for this before you pay for an extra soccer ball. Believe me or don't believe me. But the other thing that I coach organizations on is they have to protect themselves. They have one Bertrand Charest or Larry Nassar that rolls through their door, and it can sink the entire sport in that country. So it's also in an organization's best interest to focus on and make sure that this work is done and done properly, because that's how they will get protected in their liability and their insurance as well. So it's I believe athletes and administration have to work together.
And it needs to be standardized in a way, I guess, right? Mm-hmm. Across sports?
Yes.
Because if we leave it too much to each of the sports, it's going to be a system that's going to be, you know, maybe good in gymnastics, maybe great in hockey, very, very bad in skiing. And then, I don't know, there's some standard that they're trying to propose, but yet not really impose, it seems, right? Like, it's still a bit the laisser aller, like, you know, who's doing it right, who's not. And, oh, for us, it's better this way. But at one point, like, how many exceptions can you have with all the different sports we have, which there's about like 60 different sports organization?
Yeah, I mean, I've had sports, because I worked on the creation and now hopefully some of the implementation of the Universal Code of Conduct. It's not perfect, I don't think, but it's a start. And I've had sports directly say to me, well, yeah, we're okay with this as long as we can change it to make sense to our sport, because it doesn't make sense for our sport. And I'm like, no, it's not going to make sense to every sport, but in essence, it is what it is. You're not allowed to go in and change a legally binding document because it doesn't suit your sport. So for sure, Dom, there's some interpretation happening.
So you need the base, the foundation. That's the minimum, you know, standard.
Minimum standard.
If you want to add your own things to your sport that relates more to your sport, but it's an addition. It's not a, you know, removing something. This is the minimum standard, and we all have to follow it. That's what I would hope for sure.
And the one thing I'll say to parents too, and if they don't know this, they'll know now, background checks do nothing. Nothing. So do not listen if you know, you're putting your child in a summer camp, they're like, we do a background check. Great. What that means is that person had to not only have been charged with an offense, but convicted, which is in sexual assault and any sort of sexual misconduct, is less than 1%. Mm-hmm. Less than 1%. The fact that we even got a conviction in our case was like, incredible. Imagine. So, so, and that's our case. Like, and we were right. Our case was right after, Gian Gomeshi's case. So we were also completely paranoid about like the what those victims went through during his case, where they were victimized again and basically said, well, because you texted each other, you know, this whole, that whole thing was crazy. So we were very nervous about that. But a background check is useless. So you have to educate yourself. You have to only put your children in sports that are doing what they're supposed to be doing to safeguard against this, because it's just going to keep happening until, and unfortunately, to your point, Dom, at this point, it's almost a club by club and organization by organization commitment. Yeah. Unfortunately, it's not a systemic implementation because of jurisdiction, et cetera. So.
And COVID this last year too made something, what you experience as a parent for the first time. Oh, now my kid is going to do a sport, whether it's hockey, swimming, and I'm not allowed in, right? As a parent, We all lived it this year. Parents who have kids in sport, and it's not the most comfortable feeling, you know?
Yeah.
And I don't need myself to be a parent that's in the stands all the time and, you know, that kind of crazy parent that follows everything, but at least having some sort of, you know, oversight into once in a while, right? Or knowing that you can step in anytime and that coaches or the organization knows that a parent might come in and watch through the window anytime. I think it keeps people more under some sort of, you know, standard. But that was COVID. Hopefully we're out of this soon. But I think everything that you felt this year by not being able to see your kid, of course we want to see him win or perform a new trick. Okay, that's cool. But I think what we, the thing that that wall created to me was that realization is, oh my God, like it's, you know, we need to be very diligent because at the end of the day, once our kids ends up competitive and travels the world, that's like the big wall, right? They're gone. They're taking the plane and you're not having access. I think that's of what we felt in this last year of what it could be if things go bad.
And one thing I'd say to that is we're doing a very poor job of educating our children on safe sport. So there's community leader programming, there's coaching programming, there's administration programming. And why can't my 9-year-old or 10-year-old in a very conducive way to the way his mind works, be educated on the rule of two with his coaches? Like we're not even encouraging children to advocate for themselves. So his question to me is, and I obviously educated him, but his question to me was, you know, why can't I go into the change room with a coach? And you make a choice there as a parent to either stand up and recognize there's a certain level of education your child can handle, and it's you that should give it to them. Or you go, well, that's just the rules, son. And if that's the approach you take, then you haven't done your job as a parent, in my opinion. I'm not going to judge any parenting styles out there, but I think there's an opportunity for our children to know how to advocate for themselves as well. And they're not given that right now.
Yeah. Well, I'm kind of, I think it would be remiss if we don't sort of message to somebody who's out there maybe struggling with these circumstances. Like if you're a young woman or a young man who's in a situation where, you know, something is going on, like I kind of want to unpack first, like you obviously left the sport, you had to deal with a lot of things. It wasn't until one of your teammates actually said, hey, this is, you know, enough. We all have to band together. So one, talk a little bit about that struggle, and then talk two about what should somebody do who's in this situation and how, like, maybe support their thought to, I have to challenge this or I have to do something different, because I would hate to sort of leave this without giving that kind of message to somebody who's maybe dealing with these circumstances themselves.
Yeah, of course. So to your first point, I mean, Genevieve Simard, in our case, she was, you know, the ultimate champion around going to the police and having it uncovered. And anecdotally, she had never until that day admitted to being a victim of his. I knew it because of her reaction. I had a very strong feeling about it because of her reaction once he was, you know, once it was found out with the others. But it wasn't until that day and she championed and stood up for what was right and didn't know what the outcome was going to be. But as far as, you know, what people can do, I mean, call me. I mean, it's so funny, but I honestly, find me. But I mentor confidentially a ton of athletes right now, and they usually find me on Instagram, Allison Forsyth, it's my name. And I do a lot of mentoring individually with athletes, again, because I don't think the system is set up at all to support athletes through this process. I've mentored, athletes through, you know, criminal investigations, you know, what they should watch out for and the level of comfort they can have with, the RCMP as an example. Mm. I have a friend of mine here. He works, he's a sex crimes detective. So he's take goodness of his heart. He's shared with me all the what a police officer will ask and why. And I find a lot of, you know, athletes or victims get nervous and feel like they're being accused of something, but really that police officer is just trying to find out the facts to be able to present a case. There's so much education that athletes don't get. But ultimately, if you're going through this right now, then you need to look to your parent first and foremost and trust that if you're a young child, that parent is the person that you should talk to. I wish I could say that you should go to the coach or go to the administration of that organization, but to be honest, that's probably not your best approach. There is a helpline that you can call. I don't have the number with me, but it's a national helpline I'm sure you guys can find. Mm-hmm. But again, the biggest challenge is there's very few independent places to report these kind of things that are not tied in with the organization. And as much as I would like to hope right now, everyone in these organizations are the good guys that wouldn't cover up something like this. But at the end of the day, if you work for an organization, you have, whether it's a perceived, unconscious, or straight up bias towards this individual. This is someone you may have hired. This is someone you never thought could do this. It's very important that athletes feel like they can report to someone who is not a part of the organization. So there's a lot of work to be done there, but from a central message, I can say that I don't think I have regrets in this as much as I really wish the system had been different and more supportive of us back then, but I did go to the police. I was called in as a witness to another athlete's complaint against him. And at that time, as terrifying as this is, the age of consent, and I didn't admit that he had physically sexually assaulted me even until after the criminal trial. But at that time I was just speaking to them about coercion. And they basically said in the 90s, they said, 14 years of age is the age of consent. And I was like, what is happening right now? So the laws have changed. There's also no statute of limitations, which is beautiful. There's also no statute of limitations for civil cases now. So that's important as well. So if you were someone who was, sexually abused or assaulted 20 years ago, even if it's not criminal, it's a civil situation, it can still stand. But in general, I just think people need to know that at the core of who they are, like, I have more trauma from not having had this found out for 17 years than I do from actually having been with him. So my feedback as a human being and the trauma that I've had and all those years of PTSD and depression and anxiety and everything that went along with the not being able to really heal from my abuse and all that time because it was covered up, you don't want to live like that. And if you saw it and you know it was happening and you don't say anything, you don't want to live like that either. And that's not, I think it taps into your human over athlete, and that's the most important thing. This isn't about sport. It's about, humans and what's right and wrong in this world. Mm.
Take me through, maybe you don't know the words, but take me through the conversation I should have with my daughter that says this shouldn't happen to you, or this, this is what you shouldn't expect, or, I'm tangibly interested in the words, it's almost the same as the sex conversation, but it's a little different, but, what do you say? 'Cause my daughter's, she's getting coached by people in basketball and in track. And in fact, I'm going out next week to start coaching track for fun with all the kids in Trombley area, and to your point, I was asked, I have to fill out some kind of form to sort of clarify my background and things, but,
So I would say, So what I do with my kids is two things. One is I relate it to something they may have already experienced. A good place to look at is school. So in where my kids are going to school, there's a thing called hands-on and hands-off. Also for when kids don't, you shouldn't be touching other kids, hugging other kids. Teachers can't hug children. So for me, that's where I start. I just educate them. I said, how at school, your teacher doesn't hug you or touch you or send you messages after hours. So school system is not perfect for sure, but it's a lot better. Mm-hmm. And so I usually relate it back to what I know they've been sort of taught as the rules of school. That seems to get through to them. And then you can, kids are, especially your daughter, 12, by the time she's that age, and I wish I had better news, but over 70% of these cases happen in the teenage years because girls start to see themselves as adults, and predators can start to convince themselves that because that girl is just a little bit underage, it's okay. So it's usually between like 14 and 18 that these things occur. And so at that age, your child is smart. They've seen things about the Larry Nassar case. They know that something, that there's sexual abuse in the world. And so I just usually relate it to something. I'll like show them an article, or, you know, with my kids now, like Riker will Google me. And so obviously my oldest, I obviously need to be able to explain to him what he's seeing. But I have a lot of success just relating it to somewhere else in their lives that they might have been better educated, to be honest. And also not, I mean, at the end of the day, like it's horrible and it's rare. So I also have faith that, you know, it's much more sexual misconduct than what we went through. So it's a lot of conversations with children about, you know, if someone touches you and it just doesn't feel right. You know, cause it, even if it goes right to the extent that ours was, which was full on physical abuse, we could have stopped it back then. And that's what's so important about the grooming, is you stop it at the favoritism stage, because it doesn't start until you get over that stage. So you could also speak to your children about, like, I don't like that your coach is texting you. I don't like, this is inappropriate, and you have to stand for them and educate your children on what the appropriate and inappropriate behavior is of people that they're working with.
So Scotty, you're going to have that conversation?
Oh yeah.
So you'll report to us how that went.
Well, I'm going to play this podcast for my lovely wife, Jamie, and then we'll have a conversation together. But it's so powerful, Allison, and I so appreciate you coming on and being vulnerable and honest. And these are the conversations that we have to have for people to hear, so that they, from somebody who's been there and been in it and gone through it and come out the other side and is doing such great things to make a difference. So, you know, I just want to pour out my appreciation for you, your honesty today and your expression, because it's a gift to me just to listen to. And for our listeners, I'm sure there'll be plenty of fathers and mothers and people who will listen and go, wow, you know, like that was very valuable. So
yeah. And just on that, I want to thank both of you for your advocacy, and particularly Dom, you and Jen, you know, you guys both have been extreme champions of me personally and with this movement in Canada. So I'd be remiss not to mention that I obviously can't do this alone. So I'm fighting the good fight, but I have incredible champions with me. And then if anyone wanted to check out, I do have a consultancy that I've just started with a business partner called ITP Sport. So it's itpsport.ca.
Okay.
And in that, if you guys wouldn't mind sharing that, or just to share with the listeners, myself and my business partner, Elon Yampolsky, who is the expert in all of Canada on safe sport, we actually work with clubs, organizations, and individuals, athletes, on everything to do with safe sport. And we like to think we're pretty revolutionary and innovative in our approach, where anything that you need to know about safe sport, whether it's policies or training or education or, case management or anything, we have you covered. So that's also for sure a resource for people to just come onto our website and check it out, or just DM me on Instagram. I get a lot of them, and I love them, because people will take training that I've been a part of, and I answer everyone back, and I'm tireless with supporting individuals or organizations to make it better. It's my life work now. Good. So.
And it's great, because this is evolving, maybe not as fast as we wish, as I mentioned, but it's changing, you know, every day, every month. And, and we can get lost as athletes, parents, and coaches. So the good thing with an organization like yours is that you'll always know what's the latest thing, what's the solution to this, or, oh no, it's not this anymore, it's something else, right? Like, because obviously that's what I hear a lot on the ground. People are a bit lost right now. What's safe sport, you know?
Yeah, they know about it, they've heard it, it's a buzzword, but they don't know how to do anything about it. And so we can put in place very simple steps and yeah, I call it the current landscape of safe sport, because it's going to be always current, because it's constantly changing. So
that's great. Oh, that was so awesome. Thank you much. Great opportunity.
Did you have any parting messages you want to leave with the listener, or did you get it?
Thank you for letting me talk so much. You guys are probably used to asking more questions, but I just get very passionate and purposeful in this. And just be an open book with your kids, with your teams. It's not okay to make light of this. That is the number one thing that I think people do. They tick the box and they think, well, it's not going to happen to me or anyone I know, until it does. So it's all about prevention, you know, shifting upstream so that this doesn't happen. And that takes every single person in this country to be an advocate for keeping our children and our athletes safe. So my challenge to everyone is to do whatever they possibly can for themselves and for their community so we can end this before it's too late.
Well, I can't thank you enough for coming on and hanging with us. And it's always great to see you. And we will definitely bounce into each other again, I'm sure. And
yeah.
thank you for taking the time today.
Of course. Thank you, guys.
Thanks.
Have a good day. Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for joining us today on Leave Your Mark. I hope we've left a mark on you today. And we wish only that you pay it forward by sharing this story, taking the time to rate and comment on this podcast. Please follow us at Twitter at Built by Scott and Instagram at King O'Pain, and become a member of this community at Scott G. Livingston on Facebook. Have a great day. Music by Cedric de Saint-Rome.